Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty here once again for KTAH 101.9's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate and always with respect. Today I'm going to be talking with Kevin Tempest. He's a research and development scientist at the Low Carbon Prosperity Institute right here in good old Washington State. He's co-authored with an East Coast organization, Climate Exchange, a paper that's entitled Building Back Better, Investing in a Resilient Recovery for Washington State. And the recovery part is speaking about our eventual recovery from the COVID pandemic. The idea being here in this paper, as funds are invested in that recovery, a great way to invest those funds would be to invest in things that mitigate our carbon pollution and will lead to a healthier, happier, livable future. To me, one of the most interesting things about this paper is while we tend to focus on fossil fuels as a climate change problem, there are many other ways that we can change our behavior that have great benefit both to the climate, to the environment, as well as economically. So this paper is somewhat of an intersection between climate science and economics. So let's listen in. Today I'm talking to Kevin Tempest. He's the co-author of a recent Washington State document called Building Back Better, Investing in a Resilient Recovering for Washington State. And Kevin, if you wouldn't mind starting off just telling us a little bit about your Low Carbon Prosperity Institute, what the mission is, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Great to have an opportunity to talk to you today, John, and to talk about the report and our organization. I'll just mention to start off that the report was co-authored between Low Carbon Prosperity Institute, we're based in Western Washington, and Climate Exchange, who's based out in Boston. And so it was a co-authored report, and Climate Exchange is a great collaborator. They do great work, so definitely check them out as well. As far as Low Carbon Prosperity Institute, we are a small organization, a small institute that grew out of the Washington Business Alliance's Plan Washington, and that's a document that was first published in 2014. Low Carbon Prosperity was one kind of tranche of that Plan Washington, which lives on to today, but Low Carbon Prosperity really grew into kind of the primary work area for our group, and so we spun it out into its own kind of underlying entity in 2018. And at Low Carbon Prosperity Institute, our mission really is to get to effective long-term greenhouse gas reduction for Washington State. We evaluate strategies and try and guide public discussions from the state level up. And we really seek to provide a foundation for complex problem solving. This is a really complex topic, and we like to apply a systems kind of design approach to it and really utilize research and analysis. That research analysis lets us frame the various challenges and the potential solution sets. And we really feel like our strongest contribution to the conversation is to provide honest and data-driven and technically accurate information. And so one example would be our greenhouse gas reduction explorer model, which has been used for the various carbon pricing proposals that have been issued at the state level, and really digging down into the potential emissions reductions from those programs, as well as the revenue implications of those programs.
Okay, great background. Appreciate that. So a little bit about you. How did you happen to be doing what you're doing?
Yeah, so I have a basic science background, coming through with a chemistry degree, and then I started off going to oceanography at the UW for my graduate program. But I really just was really attracted to kind of the more applied, intractable, you know, problem of our time, which is what do we do about our fossil fuel addiction? What do we do about the changing climate? How do we move to a future that will actually work for humanity. So I went from graduate school to work at the Stockholm Environment Institute on climate and energy, and did some great research there, and then moved on to join Washington Business Alliance and the Low Carbon Prosperity Institute, helped co-found that as its own entity out of the Washington Business Alliance, and really started going down the Washington State specific route with Washington Business Alliance right around the time that Initiative 732, so the first of the most recent initiatives around a carbon tax was being considered in Washington State.
Yeah, understood. So one of the things that I'm interested in is the younger generations as they come online. So I'm just curious, how old were you or what were the circumstances when you first started becoming aware of and concerned about the climate future?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the cliche story, I guess. I was a college student when Inconvenient Truth came out from Al Gore. And so I know that's, you know, a polarizing, certainly a very, very polarizing documentary that he put out. But it was really impactful for me. And I was always, you know, I was always an outdoorsy kid growing up. My parents took me out to all the national parks in the summer. We did lots of backpacking trips and things like that. So certainly the natural world has always been something that I really think about. So starting to think more about the interaction with what was shown in Inconvenient Truth and the topics I was studying in oceanography and really gaining an awareness of it. And I'd say one really formative bit of background is the program on climate change at University of Washington. So a graduate student led kind of program, interdisciplinary. You get to work with, organize events and sessions, conferences with students across different disciplines. And so really digging in through the program on climate change was really influential for me as well.
So are you a native Washingtonian?
Yeah, I am born and raised. Actually grew up on Mercer Island, went to high school there, and my parents still live there. Since left and come back, went to school in Pennsylvania and spent a couple more years abroad after that.
Yeah, so my guess is that you have a similar sense to a lot of people that live in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, how much we love the, let's call it the natural environment, for lack of a better term, this incredible body of water, the Salish Sea, Puget Sound, the mountains we've got, Mount Rainier, the Olympics. I personally just look around and think to myself how blessed I am to live in such a beautiful place, and at the same time carrying these concerns about we're really not doing a good job with it. Do those vibes sound familiar to you?
Those are 100%. I catch those vibes. Yeah, I mean, we live in such an incredible, beautiful slice of the world. And I even love just going across the mountains to Eastern Washington and taking folks who aren't from Washington there. And you know, all of a sudden they recognize that there's desert landscapes and these massive coulees and everything in Washington State that they've never associated with it. So I think every direction you go, you know, from Seattle, which is, you know, kind of my base, but there's just such incredible, incredible landscapes and vistas and communities, and definitely something that I want to make sure that we can pass down. I have a 9-month-old, our first son, and I definitely want to be able to share those experiences and pass it down with him.
Yeah, for sure. Well, congratulations on the new baby. My child rearing years are far behind me. Every once in a while, I see a young family and I get a little nostalgic for that, but I get over it pretty fast. So one of the things that I think people that are concerned about the climate and the ecology in general, it's a bit of a challenge, and that is, who do we trust? Because most of us don't have the kind of technical scientific background you do. And so we rely a lot on trustworthy sources. So I just like to ask the Low Carbon Prosperity Institute, how is that financed?
Yeah, we're really kind of a foundation model. And so co-founders of the Washington Business Alliance were David Giuliani, who's still very active, chief engineer, he likes to call himself, for Low Carbon Prosperity Institute. And he was the inventor of Sonicare toothbrush and Clarisonic as well, and Howard Behar from Starbucks background. David remains very active in Low Carbon Prosperity Institute today. But we're really a lean organization, and so we've done, you know, we've certainly had some funding and project work from elsewhere. But this particular work that we're talking about today was, you know, just a joint collaborative effort with Climate Exchange, just kind of our two organizations working internally.
Okay, sounds great. So let's dig in a little bit further here. I did spend some time studying the paper, and I'm going to have a
reference to that paper on our show notes for listeners who want to dig into it for themselves. And I do highly recommend digging into it. One of the things I say constantly is, if we care about the climate future, we have to do our homework. And this is a great encapsulated way of looking at possibilities for Washington State in particular going forward. And of course, we tend to care more about what's local to us than what's further away. So one of the key things, and correct me if you don't think this is a key thing in the paper, is kind of comparing the value over time of investing in green energy going forward versus what we could call the typical industrial return. Is that fair to say that that's one of the key focuses of the paper?
Yeah, I would definitely say that is the type of sort of vision that this paper was evaluating. So we want to take a look at these, you know, we call it a resilient recovery to start, but, you know, it sort of is jump-starting that longer-term sustainable deep decarbonization approach. And yeah, what we really do find is there is a very positive net return on benefit from embracing that approach as opposed to kind of sticking with the status quo, if you will.
Understood. One of the things that I see a lot, and I'm sure you do too, is that there are a lot of folks out there who are dragging their heels or resisting shifts to cleaner energy because they are concerned that it's going to raise their taxes, that it's going to result in more government regulation, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure you're familiar with the perspective. So I'll ask my question in this way. So in industry, the investments, quote unquote, are from investors. I'm talking about for-profit industry corporations and so on. The funds are from investors. And you speak of investing in green energy kinds of things going forward. So how would you describe the investments for that? Where are the investments going to come from?
Yeah, so our report isn't necessarily taking a stance on where exactly those investments need to come from. But I think, you know, we're operating under kind of an underlying assumption that in this moment where we're facing concurrent crises, that stimulus from the federal level on down is a big part of that. And so how do we deploy that in the way that returns the most impact is sort of the question that we were looking to answer. I think that the industry question is an interesting one. And one note I would make is there's a lot of studies out there that actually look at sort of how public investment, you know, which would be the case for something like a stimulus package, leverages private financing. And so that's not something this report really got into, but, you know, I can share a link to this, but the group E2 really looked at kind of the national level and a bunch of sort of federal programs that have been in place and found really high leveraging indexes. So the amount of private funding that a public investment brings on board is really high. It's, you know, on the order I've seen, you know, I think they were up around 5 to 1. So this does actually mobilize and motivate a whole lot of private investment. That's not something our report really goes into depth in. But I would also just kind of point back to something like the fossil fuel industry and the subsidies that we know are received there, and they're a massive scale. You know, I think trillions of dollars a year, at least globally. It's a huge amount of money that, if it was redeployed, could return a lot better. It would return a lot more to society than this decision to subsidize what are typically known as private industries. So I think it cuts both ways a little bit there. But, you know, what we're looking at here in our report is really job creation, it's public health benefits, and it's climate benefits. Yeah, so I would just say in terms of what this report looks at in terms of the job creation efficiency, in terms of community health benefits, and in terms of the climate benefits that it returns.
So the leveraging point that you just made is a very interesting one to me, and actually one I hadn't thought of. So in a certain sense, we could look possibly at the funds coming from the federal government or the state government as seed money that would be enough to get a project started, and private industry would be able to pick it up from there. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
That's exactly right. And you could think about that in a couple of ways. I mean, we look at like a per million dollars invested in our report. Well, you could look at that as, you know, each $1 million invested really could generate $5-10 million in actual projects, programs, and deployment of capital. Or you could look at it as, you know, okay, a 1 million might only require, you know, a couple hundred thousand. And I'll plug a little interesting report I've just run across recently. It was just recently published, called Rewiring America. And they did this exercise across essentially electrifying everything across the economy by 2035. So huge, massive scale kind of study. And their estimate was out of the $25 or $30 trillion it might take in upfront costs, which would actually return net savings to the average household because of the sort of the downstream cost impacts on fuels and things like that. But they found that out of that, it would be about 10% of that would be from government financing, and the rest of it would be leveraged.
Right. Yeah, I am somewhat familiar with that report you're talking about, and I'll make sure there's a link to that in our show notes. So to change focus just a little bit here, of course, as you mentioned earlier in our conversation, a big part of the paper is about green jobs. And I think that's a great topic to talk about, because I think folks who are concerned about the climate, including myself, we tend to think about the bad things that are going to happen if we don't take action. But there are a lot of good things out there, and it's a mistake for us to ignore those or to put them in the background. So to look at additional good green jobs is a cause for optimism. Within that framework, and by the way, the paper talks a lot about those good green jobs. Not too long ago, I had a conversation with a union board. It was a board of a number of union leaders, and they were complaining. They were electricians, and they were complaining to me that the green jobs, like in wind farms, solar, and so on, that involve electricians, that those are paying less than what their union scale is. So I do think that we tend to talk about the numbers of green jobs, not so much talk about the compensation that those green jobs bring. So could you comment on that?
Yeah, I can't go into too much specifics on that exact and on that example that you put out there. I would say we do need to make a real effort to make sure that these jobs that are part of paving the way to a better future are family wage jobs, that there are, where possible, kind of access to opportunities to unionize and things like that. So I think it would be unfortunate if those jobs, which are some of the fastest growing industries, fastest growing jobs, at least before the pandemic, really, really hammered the industry hard, but I expect it will pick back up again. It would be a shame if those rapidly growing industries were being sort of left behind in terms of being good careers, essentially. So our report does not really get into that level of granularity in terms of job quality. I think it's important to note that if these are sort of policy driven, if these are legislation driven, that there needs to be a very conscious effort to make sure that these are accessible. These jobs are accessible to all different types of communities, and that these jobs are good jobs. These are important jobs, and they should be, they should be treated as being very important. What I can say from our report and our programs and projects, if you look at them, are not heavily renewable power focused necessarily. But we do find that the average wages and benefits, which is essentially as granular as we can get on this job quality, with our methodology, that those are above the state average. So they do outpace the state average. They are above average for the average job within this portfolio. And they're heavily construction jobs as well. That's the biggest category. So about a fifth of the jobs in the portfolio would be construction related jobs, as well. So, that's really, so, not the level of detail I think I can get into the solar versus other electricians.
Yeah, no. So you do make a good point, and that is that the paper it extends far beyond just the field of green energy. There are so many other things, forestry and transportation and so on, that we might not think of. Agriculture, we might not think of specifically as climate mitigating efforts, but the truth is that they are. So in that regard, one of the things that surprised me was that the forest conservation and ecosystem restoration really stood out as having high benefit. Could you fill in a little bit about what it is about that area that leads to such high benefits?
Yeah, absolutely. That did really stand out. And I just want to pop back to your previous question real quick, because there is one further point I want to make. And that's that when we did, again, look at these kind of at the aggregate level, a couple of factors really stood out. You know, one thing is that you often hear that green jobs and green investments are going to be money losers, essentially. But our research really found the opposite to be true. So when we looked at the total value added of investing $1 million in the projects that made up our resilient recovery portfolio, they returned essentially to the gross state product, the GDP of Washington State. They returned almost twice as much back into the economy and the value added to the economy as the 10 largest industries. So the really entrenched industries that we think of in Washington State, the biggest players. And the other factor is that even if the jobs in these industries are above average, but don't pay as highly as, you know, software engineers and aerospace engineers and those types of jobs, we found that in aggregate, because of the job potential, because of the job efficiency, the greater job growth in those industries, that actually you invest $1 million, more of that ends up as employee compensation. So more of that winds up back in the workers' pockets than would for $1 million injected to the economy at large, or $1 million, injected towards the biggest industries in the state. So there really is, on the aggregate level, you get more value added to the state, and you get more of the money going back to the employees. So at the aggregate level, I think that, you know, that's kind of challenging some of these assumptions, and it doesn't necessarily, you know, change the on the ground experience of what you're talking about in that specific instance. But I think kind of from the bigger conceptual level, we're seeing, better for labor, better for the overall state economy. And that's not a message that you often hear. So that's a point I really want to make clear as one of the findings of the report. Yeah. And so then onto the question John, of the what really stands out from climate benefits from what we've deemed forest conservation and ecosystem restoration. That was a really interesting one to dive into, that we did some of kind of our deepest dive into, particularly the what's called the Wildfire Prevention and Preparedness Program. And we found really astounding climate and community health benefits. And I think anyone who's been here in the Pacific Northwest and who's lived through any of these summers where we've had weeks of just almost apocalyptic air quality, it may not be that surprising. To our collaborators in Boston, it was, you know, maybe a little bit more surprising to think that there can be such high community health and climate benefits to that. And why that is, really, and we're talking about, you know, $12.5 million in benefits from avoided climate damages and from avoided air quality leading to premature mortality for every $1 million invested. So one reason is that forest burning just generate a whole lot of air pollution, in particular small particulate matter, and a lot of greenhouse gases, not fossil fuel, but greenhouse gases that would otherwise be stored long term on the land. So there's an incredible amount of pollution that's associated with these. At the same time, the costs for doing the forest protection, doing the thinning, getting in there and being proactive, and lessening the risk of especially large scale forest fires that are the ones that really cause the most damage, just aren't that expensive, is what we found. And so what's interesting here is, you know, this is one of the most Washington specific well-researched programs that we were able to include in this program. We have a 20-year plan from DNR, Department of Natural Resources, around this. We have a really in-depth bill that was evaluated very heavily by the Office of Fiscal Management, that does a fiscal note on each bill. And that's from Representative Fitzgibbon from the last session. And it didn't pass. It wasn't funded. So I think, you know, if we had one program as sort of a takeaway, the wildfire prevention and preparedness. And I would just add that that's another program that also scores very well on job efficiency and at right around state average wages and benefits. So, so it really was a high level conclusion that we really want to be able to carry forward and get the message out about.
Yeah, cool. Well, we will carry a link to that bill also so that our listeners can be paying attention to that next time legislature is in session. It is exciting to think that we could get such great benefits from taking better care of our forests, not only the deleterious effects of pollution and so on that come with the fires, but saving those forests for the things we love to do, you know, the hiking, the camping, the fishing, the sightseeing, all those things. So just particularly interesting
those other benefits that we don't. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Sorry, John, so, I was just going to say all those other benefits that we aren't even quite capturing here. It's kind of the classic win, 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 and win beyond that. So.
Yeah. So good stuff is not always obvious up front. And especially in our culture, we tend to measure good stuff by dollars rather than less specific things, just like enjoying life, time with family, enjoying nature and things like that. So, okay. So I wanted to ask you about low carbon agriculture. Full disclosure here, I don't know a damn thing about low carbon agriculture. So could you give a brief overview of what that means exactly and why it's a benefit in terms of climate change?
Sure. And I think we're still wrapping our heads around exactly what that means. It's definitely one of the most underexplored investment areas in our report. But specific to our report, we're really looking at two different programs. That would be dairy digesters, so that take methane from dairy operations and turn it into usable fuel. And often there's also, you know, from the manure, there's other end use products like fertilizers and whatnot that can be used. And then irrigation efficiency, so more efficient ways to get water to agriculture, essentially. So those are the two that we looked at in that realm. I think there's a lot more territory to explore there, and that's one of our most active areas of outreach here, I think, as we try and envision how to grow the resilient recovery portfolio, how to create an even more compelling and more comprehensive list of investments, lists of opportunities, more so than even investments. And so one thing that I would say that would fit neatly into low carbon agriculture is this idea around sort of natural carbon sequestration. I'll plug Carbon Washington led effort on sustainable farms and fields bill that was passed this year that looks at sequestering carbon into farms and agricultural fields. So I think that's one area we'd really like to go more in depth on. And it ties back to actually some polling that LCPI did this winter around opportunities to reduce greenhouse gas pollution. And really what stood out from that survey, and I can provide you a link to some of the findings from that survey, is that these solutions around sequestration in productive lands and in forests has broad bipartisan support. It has broad support across generations. It has broad support rural, urban. It was the one that really stuck out as having kind of the most, the most support for. So that would be part and parcel, I think, to low carbon agriculture. And then you could even envision getting into things like diets and food waste and things like that as being part of that low carbon agriculture system as well. Inputs as well, fertilizers and different ways of growing crops and things like that.
Well, so the across the board support for that kind of approach is very interesting to me because, of course, we live in this polarized environment where the moment something is proposed, people choose upsides and start throwing rocks at each other. And I'm kind of looking for instances where that's not the case as maybe starting points. You know, if we can start agreeing on A, find that we can compromise, negotiate, and so on, and get to a successful solution, then that starts opening up the door for maybe B, C, D, and E on down the line. So that's really an intriguing topic area and something that I'm going to encourage folks to dig into more deeply. And we'll look forward to hearing more of your research as time passes on that. So we've got about 5 or so minutes left. I'm just wondering, do you have an active program where you're making sure your paper is read by decision makers and the community going forward so that it becomes a part of the dialogue?
Yeah, we're definitely in active outreach mode. One thing we did shortly after we released the paper, so about a month ago, is we held a public webinar. And so that's available on our website, and we'll make sure that we can get you a link to that as well. So just sharing our key findings of the report and fielding questions. We're really starting to ramp up our outreach right now, although we've definitely been having conversations with key legislators throughout, and we're really planning to, as fall comes along and there's more committee activity and things like that, to take these take this report and these findings directly to those committees and hope to do some presentations and things as well.
Awesome. Well, so that triggers a thought in my mind is, and let's touch base again as the legislative season approaches, so we can talk about the rubber meeting the road, so to speak, politically, where research starts showing up in proposed bills and to create public interest in that. Of course, until the government takes action on a lot of this stuff, then their ideas, great ideas maybe, but just ideas. So in the meantime, have you gotten feedback of one kind or the other from folks in government or in industry on the paper?
We've received lots of positive feedback. I think you touched on something right there, though. I think we'll see the most energy motivated is when there's really some idea of how these investments can start to materialize. That's when I think folks will be really excited to sort of expand the list to make it more holistic, to raise more awareness of other good projects that are there that maybe slipped through the cracks or went past our blinders, and that kind of stuff. So for now, I think, you know, and this was always our intent of the research, I think it lays a great foundation and gives those strong components and advocates for good, smart policy for moving to actually reach our state targets for 2030 and 2050. It gives them really strong ground to stand on. It really says, you know, if you don't like these types of programs that we've advocated for around carbon pricing, around different standards for pollution reduction, and those types of things, then you need to explain at the same time why you are against the job creation, why you're against the public health benefits. And so, you know, that was sort of our intention, was to query what the real benefits are, and then to really, really highlight the opportunity here so that it's impossible to ignore in the conversation. So I think you're right. As policy developments, as stimulus or whatever type of revenue approaches become more available, I think that the excitement is going to really grow around this exact concept.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. And I'm just curious, does LCPI give testimony before committees at the legislature?
Yes, we do. We are a 501c3, how we operate. So we're not allowed to specifically advocate, but we still see our mission is to provide that honest, data-driven kind of assessment of impacts on policy. So we certainly have. Cap and Invest is one that we've been very active on. Previous carbon pricing, the 100% clean power, also known as the Clean Energy Transition Act that passed, we provided analysis and testimony on that as well.
Okay, excellent. Well, we're close to the end here, and I will just say to our listeners that the paper has so much more in it than what we've discussed here. We've really just scratched the surface of the paper. The paper's readable, but it's also well-documented and it's compacted. So especially with the graphics of charts and so on, which are a shorthand way of comparing different things and understanding what's going on, I especially appreciate the data and the research that went into the document, because it seems that so much of our political dialogue these days is just about opinions And while opinions have their place, they're no substitute for going out into the real world and figuring out what's going on out there. So I encourage everybody to pay attention to that paper, and you'll be rewarded for your efforts. So what's going to happen with LCPI going forward? What's hot on your agenda right now?
I mean, I think there is just an incredible amount of work to be done around a resilient recovery, around building back better, around this unique moment that we're in. So we are looking for opportunities to raise awareness and of this type of work in other states, with specific analysis for other states. We're looking at Oregon. Climate Exchange is already active in doing a similar project in Massachusetts. We would love to scale that. At, you know, at the state level on up and coalitions of states. And then certainly we're looking at how to improve this. This is, you think this was a very, very rewarding piece of research, but it also was super quick to try and respond to the moment. We really hammered it out, and I'm proud of what it was, but it was definitely an accelerated process. So we want to take a deep breath and really be critical of what we may have missed, what other lenses, what other programs there are that really can strengthen this concept. And then we want to see exactly how these specific investments and this investment concept can feed into the 2021 legislative cycle in Washington State. And in particular, we've always believed the investments, especially since we were so late to really get started on reducing our emissions, the investments are going to be absolutely critical. So we're excited about continuing legislation like a cap and invest bill that could raise a lot of revenue, provide certainty on the emissions trajectory for the state, and be able to redeploy those investments in ways that generate these tremendous benefits like we've shown in the Building Back Better report.
Yeah, one of the things you said in there too, which I find particularly intriguing, is the idea that Washington State can play some role in terms of mentoring leadership to other states to take this kind of approach to looking at the climate future, an approach that's practical and it's nonpartisan and shows the benefits versus the costs that we're bound for right now. So that's, you know, as a Washingtonian, that's a pretty cool idea to me. So we're out of time here, Kevin, and I just want to say that I get your passion for this topic, and I'm very appreciative of it. Not only are you passionate for the topic, but I believe that you're also passionate for doing your homework, doing clear, clean research, and presenting that research in a clean and clear way that's accessible to the layperson. So thanks for all you do.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. That's certainly what we aim for, and we know this is a complex but extremely important problem, and we just want to make sure everyone realizes that the opportunities for a better future really, really do exist. So let's work together, and we'd love to hear from anyone. I will make sure you have my contact information. Reach out if you want to know more, if you'd like us to provide a presentation to a group or anything like that, or you just have thoughts to offer on how to make our next work product better. We'd love to hear from you.
Sounds great. We'll get that publicized. Okay, thanks again, Kevin.
Well, there you go. And it was great talking to Kevin to get a peek inside the thinking from a guy who's done an incredible amount of research and has done a great job of expressing it through this paper. One of the takeaways for me is we do have reasons for optimism. We can create a brighter, healthier, happier, livable future if we have the political will to do that. One of the things that I'm suggesting is that you, me, we get ready to lobby our elected representatives in the legislature in the next session. That's where many of these ideas are going to be considered in terms of making them into law. I'd like to also add that our program notes are going to be what I'd call copious. They're useful, helpful, honest, and reliable sources of information about climate, and especially with the intersection of economics. So check them out. You can check them out at ccltacoma.org. And I'd also love to hear from you if you have any comments. I read every email and will comment on the air in response to your email if that's appropriate. So that's it for today. As always, reminding you, Live like the mountain is out. Take care.